Randy Martin is professor and chair of art and public policy at the Tisch School of the Arts, New York University, and current president of the CSA. He is author, most recently, of An Empire of Indifference, American War, and the Financial Logic of Risk Management, and is working, and there were many before that, and is working on a book entitled Under New Management, Universities, Administrative Labor, and the Professional Turn. Tonight we will have our first respondent is Annie McLennan, who will receive her PhD in English from Berkeley this spring. Her dissertation is titled Salto Mortale, Narrative Speculation and the Chance of the Future. Ooh, I like that. I hadn't read that. And looks at the relationship between both financial and military speculation and 21st century cultural production. Yeah. An essay from her dissertation titled Futures Shock, Plausibility, Preemption, and the Fiction of 9/11 will be appearing this May in the journal Simploc. She is also a co-organizer of Berkeley's Interdisciplinary Marxisms Working Group. Thank you, Annie, for being here. Samuel Benales has an academic background in Latin American literature and ethnic studies and is currently a PhD student in anthropology at UC Berkeley. His research focuses on the intersections between age, race, activism in the San Francisco Bay Area. Samuel had a leading role in organizing the statewide Queer People of Color summits of 2007 and 2008, and the recent Decolonizing the University Conference commemorating the 40th anniversary of UC Berkeley's Ethnic Studies Department. And we're so happy to have you here, too. So are you going to talk from the edge, or do you want to be in the middle?
Oh, the edge. I just thought maybe just for a moment I would try and throw my own shoe.
I'm just going to keep it.
And then I'll give it back, you know, because shoes should circulate. So, you know, I know that these kinds of occasions, they're supposed to be something valedictory, and for cultural studies, you would be imagining this object called cultural studies and interrogating it, and, you know, we've all read fabulous versions of it, just exactly that kind of work. And I come, not, you know, not, neither to praise nor bury that work, but to try and displace it back to us. Right? That is to say, I want to take as my object the Cultural Studies Association itself and start to imagine what kind of work we might be doing together, understanding that this is something that is speculative, right? And that it's located within what have to be the dilemmas of trying to create and build and project precisely this kind of association, if it's going to be more than what this is, which is substantial already, right? An annual gathering, but something, you know, that we don't just harvest once a year, but to continue to harvest, right? As we go through and try and reformulate who we are and what we are. And I think, of course, there's a dilemma for any kind of radical, alternative, projective professional association, and that's, of course, the dilemma of both being stitched into the institution, right? And that institution has, in other ways, betrayed us, right? So it's a kind of impossible desire that nonetheless, rather than escaping, we want to try and sustain and open up and see what's possible there. Then I think the other thing that's evident in terms of the CSA itself is, you know, this is a, you probably have noticed, this is a non-monogamous organization, right? That we have many associations and affiliations, right? So the question is, what affiliations can derive from both that multiplicity and the particular crossing of this one? And I'm saying this also mindful of being here and being at Berkeley and how significant it is to be at a place that is at the crossroads of so many of the different crises. We shouldn't necessarily wear that itself as a badge of honor, but I think reflecting on what it means to organize and associate amidst the crisis of the university, the crisis of knowledge production, and I think in terms of the stakes of what is being compacted and compounded here, the crisis of society itself as an idea of the possibility of, you know, strangers being in some sort of cooperative relationship together. Right, which we seem to be potentially being robbed of in the moment. And I think it's worth trying to ask, so what is it that cultural studies has to do with this? What is the specificity of cultural studies in relation to this? And what kind of work can we imagine projecting out of that affiliation and association. I think it's particularly challenging, given that in some ways we could say that the cultural itself is often subject to a kind of narrative of disappointment and betrayal. And part of that has to do with its very genealogy and itineraries and projection, right? Starting off as something that was, in the Arnoldian sense, to be something that could be achieved, right? But understanding, of course, that achievement came with all kinds of exclusions. So anyone could do it, anyone could achieve excellence, but of course the point of excellence was to leave most out, right? Who weren't the best and the brightest, or the notion of a kind of wholeness of the anthropological conception of culture that seemed to establish an equivalence only in the context, right, of the elimination of what might count as the basis, the social basis of that equivalence around the world, right? Or culture in the sociological Parsonian sense of common value integration, right? As a kind of compensation for this onslaught of rationalization. And yet again, leaving that compensation as something that then is cruelly withered and reduced, and we might say that in some ways at least the Birmingham kind of canonical genealogy of cultural studies and understanding that kind of Anglocentric narrative and account is part of the problem, right? In thinking about what cultural studies is and might be, nonetheless, that too in certain ways was an idea of culture as this autonomous domain, right, as something that was not captured or colonized by labor, and something that was for the working class outside of the strictures, of those versions and iterations of labor, right, something that where life could be valued and created, that wasn't subject to those conditions of alienation, and of course the notion then that the cultural becomes this launchpad of difference against the homogenization of the market and commodification. So all of those notions, even we could say are, in certain sense our own, if we identify with that other one, rest on some conception of autonomy. And what concerns me is, with respect to the cultural and with respect to academic labor, that kind of linchpin of autonomy as a founding condition is eroding, and that the temptation to try and retrieve it may diminish or keep from our view precisely the political prospects and organizational prospects that are opening in our midst. So clearly, if we're talking about the case of the cultural, capital, of course, very savvy, this thing called capital, caught on to how yummy the cultural was, right? That this was, of course, a field that, if it was to be initially autonomous and delicious, could nonetheless be colonized and captivated. And, of course, much of what constitutes as that edge of capital, which stands for the intellectual properties, right, of teletechnology and biogenetics and finance, the commodification of knowledge, is precisely, we could say, this incorporation, this celebration of the prospects of incorporating the cultural into the thing called capital. And therefore, we would ask, is that therefore a safe domain or an outside domain or an autonomous domain from which we could orient some meaningful set of political differences? So, with that set of problems, we might say, of course, that we're talking also then about the what would have seemed to be the crowning moment of academics and academic labor and intellectual prospects, right? Which is not so long ago, if we remember the discussions of the 60s and the 70s, the anxiety was that the professional managerial class would be the new Mandarins. Right, they would somehow betray the working class in pursuit of their own self-interest. Right? So that's also a narrative of autonomy, and that autonomy of a class and its particular command of its own domain of expertise was going to cede to it the capacity of self-regulation. Right? So those anxieties about a sort of wonk-driven world, in which professionalization would reign supreme. And of course, that figured a central place for the university, because where are people going to professionalize but through the university? Right? So this seeming democratization, expansion of access to higher education has something to do with this formation of the professional managerial class. But we could say now, looking at that situation, it almost seems ironic that we would have imagined it possible to overinvest in the autonomy and the sovereignty of the professional managerial class. And if anything, this same moment that we often narrate, right, is the kind of undoing of our condition, whether that's narrated with, you know, the breakup of Bretton Woods, post-Fordism, neoliberalism, Thatcher and Reagan. We also have to see that is a moment of a certain kind of both formation in the sense of expansion, but also decomposition, at least of that particular compact or version or set of claims of what the professional managerial class might be. And I think if we think about that period, say the last 30 years of this both fluorescence and withering, which I think if we're going to return to that notion of class, it has to be as something that is problematic in that sense, that it's not simply an occupational category or a relation to surplus value, but some sort of principle or premise of affiliation or association, that something is both being brought together, forced together, and prized apart simultaneously. And that is, of course, part of what's vertiginous about our condition. And we might say that, of course, that period is also a period of the shifting away of welfare state compacts, of the public good, of a whole kind of cluster bomb, if you will, of organizing principles that run across conceptions of state and labor and society and of conceptions of development and futurity, right? Because presumably that was the idea of professional managerial class as this kind of meritocratic, knowledge-driven, self-accomplishing, self-made entity or subjectivity. Right? And of course, in actuality, the last 30 years, we could say, has been a process of the unhinging between the dimensions of that professional managerial class, that professionalization continues apace. There isn't anything we could say that isn't professionalized, but in terms of its ability to command a particular domain of knowledge, that has withered as the managerial dimension, right, has expanded. So what sort of cuts across all of these different professionalized entities is not their ability to say, yes, this church, this domain belongs to me, but there's a kind of rampant managerialism, right, which manifests itself in terms of a turn away from security, a demand towards accountability, of measurability, of performance-based dimensions of productivity. And of course, this is a time, the last 30 years, where productivity is continuing to go up, and we'd have to say it's going up for the professionals as much as for other kinds of labor. But salaries, wages, conditions of security are going down, right? So that productivity gap, I want to suggest, is going to also manifest itself in terms of a particular kind of academic crisis. And then we know, of course, this is the time of particular kinds of job crises, right? First, the casualization of higher education as a condition of its expansion, right? A subvention through part-time labor, through casualized labor, right? of what is going to be a real expansion. And of course, that expansion is not, as anyone could tell you, happening here. The main dimensions of expansion in higher education are in community colleges, which are 40% of freshmen are in community college. And the biggest growth area for higher education, which are the proprietaries. And I think it's important to consider, you know, if the 60s were the heyday of the creation of public education and give us systems like this, you know, on the scale of 500,000, that's precisely how many students Phoenix University, right, the largest proprietary institution claim, right? So we're talking about scales of the constitution of access to education. And of course, the thing that we would have to say about the proprietaries is that they are not in any way private. 80% of the proprietary's income, and Phoenix University in particular, comes from government underwritten student loans, right? So this is a government program to create a privatization of higher education, precisely at a moment, right, when the thing we're calling the public sector is getting evaporated and eviscerated. But I think we have to appreciate that kind of movement and this advent of managerialism comes in relation to this breakdown of security, of thinking that it is indeed the realm of the private itself, of private initiative, which is where the moral fiber of a citizenry, of a civic entity, of a nation, of a population comes from. And we have to deal with the paradox that governments and bipartisan governments, governments across the formal political spectrum, such as we have one, have been the principal purveyors of this idea of privatization, This is not coming from the private sector. This is the voice of the state, which is, of course, what makes it so challenging to turn back to that very state and say, please, would you give me my public back? Because there, you know, it was they, not just in the sense of tax cuts, but in the sense of the retooling of this notion of security now as risk management and self-management and accountability and performance, which now becomes not just a way of knowing, but the kind of ontology of being, right, that we come to know so well. How do we know it? We know it in academia because performance is the measure of our outlier. And the political economy, right, of this kind of statistical accountability is that you raise the median, the midpoint, you know, the mass of labor by focusing on the outliers, right? The stars, the high performers, those who can exceed the productivity norms and therefore establish what they are for everyone else. And it's on that basis, of course, that academics are themselves implicated in this problem of performance. Right, that is really the measure of our own productivity gap, which simply means that the mass of labor in higher education as elsewhere, right, is not sharing in the spoils of that extra surplus, that extra work, that extra labor that's getting produced. And we'd have to then say, if we're going to think about this kind of account in relation to something like the professional association, that this is presenting us with a very specific kind of dilemma, because the professional association is based precisely on a kind of Faustian bargain, going back to the American Association of University Professors founding in 1915, right? Which is to say a kind of God and Caesar division. You let us be a peerage, where we judge one another on the basis of the restricted domain of our own expertise, and we'll call that academic freedom. And we're going to turn over to you, the administrators, the running of the institution. Right? So this anxiety that cuts through cultural studies about this split between the cultural and the political economic, we could say, lies at the foundation of the social compact that charges and generates and animates the professional itself. And so that too, just like the call to the return to the public, the call to a return to academic freedom as a kind of emancipatory moment or a place, a safe harbor that we can return to, in some sense we'd have to worry about what the effects of that initial social compact had been. And of course that social compact was not meant to be generalized. The idea of tenure was, you know, for the Deweys and the Lovejoys who were forming the AAUP at the time, that they could move anywhere in higher education, right, nationally. So they were constituting a kind of national labor market that was a highly restricted economy. So clearly what's often narrated as the golden age of higher education, the 60s, where there's this momentary disarticulation between expansion of educational production and capacity and academic labor in the form of PhDs, looks now much more like an interregnum, right? A moment not that was not sustainable, obviously, right? Where the kind of expansion and the credentialing capacity made it look as if two writers, Jenks and Reisman, writing in 1968, called the academic revolution, by which they said it would be the faculty who were leading through their control of the institution. But they really just meant their comportment of the production of knowledge through peer review. What would be an adequate set of conditions for the kind of permanent control by faculty of the institution. So I'm trying to set up what we would take as our default loves, right? Things like public and autonomy, and worry about how stable these are as home bases, and ask if we can go home to them or not, right? Will they call us back? And if not, what might we imagine that we can do or that we could do, right? If indeed there has been a kind of drift away from those very foundations of our own kind of organization. And that's where I think we have an opportunity here to venture some kind of alternative. And I think we'd have to think about this in terms of three kinds of modalities of our operation. Right? One would be self-dissemination. What does it mean to generate the means through which knowledge circulates precisely in a context in which it has been the command of that circulation of knowledge right, that has led the university to give up its autonomy, right? And that's what the Bayh-Dole Act is about, right? On the one hand, it's about universities being able to keep the change from the kind of rush to patents. But it also meant that the universities abdicated their own specificity, right, as being autonomous spheres for the production of education and as an ends in itself. Not that that was ever the case, right, but it certainly was a set of claims, and the abdication had the concrete form of multiplying by a factor of 7 the number of patents that universities actually file, but universities as a whole only constitute 5% of the total number of patents, right? If that's just a sort of very crude formalization of what it means, right, to be in this kind of race. So now universities are really, of course, the small fish in a much, much larger ocean, rather than being able to make this kind of privileged claim. And of course, that resonates with all of the kinds of claims of bad faith, Me Tooism, you know, step to the front of the line, right, in which education finds itself now, right, in terms of trying to privilege its place in relation to others. Because again, that kind of Faustian bargain, and I'm not saying that the universities were to blame for this, but they certainly had an agency, right, and have deployed this logic of productivity along the lines of strategic investments, which means concentrating in centers of excellence in moments in which a particular kind of initiative is going to be leveraged to the reputational effect and the ranking effect of the institution as a whole. So that kind of movement, right, it's interesting, the former University of Michigan president Duderstadt called an essential singularity. It's not for him a Negrian turn of phrase, but comes from engineering, right? And the idea that if you focus on obsessively, right, on one variable in one area, it will have effects, residual effects all around it, you know, which you could say explains a certain kind of disposition of senior university administrators, right? That obsession, right, with getting the star or creating the center, which stands in for leadership, which is also their mandate, to be those leaders, but they are, of course, leaders of the singularity, right, rather than leaders of the mass. So that kind of problem then, of course, means that, again, those who labor in higher education are the sources of a productivity in which they can have no claim on, to which they're only measured against, to which that problem of accountability, and it's interesting that one of the protocols of this accountability that gets developed in the 1980s is called benchmarking. Benchmarking comes from IBM's failure to get the shift from mainframe computing to personal computing. So they were gonna change, right, from the kind of pure research of, you know, blue sky engineering and planning, that is to say inputs in that quaint and cute turn of phrase, to outputs. And we could say that this then gets translated into higher education in terms of a non-translatability of the specialization of knowledge, that what benchmarking takes as its problem is that no one can understand what in the world academics do, but the implication is suddenly they're supposed to, stakeholders, the public, somebody or other, anybody who can make a claim on higher education, taxpayers, are supposed to suddenly get what the specialties and the professionals were doing. And because they can't, there has to be a translation from an input, that is to say thinking, to an output, that is to say some sort of assessable, accountable result or consequence of what it means to learn something. And that, we could say, is the most baleful vision of interdisciplinarity that we could conceive of, right? Something that is infinitely translatable, right, as a way of rendering equivalent knowledge, but only doing that so that we can introduce some larger principle of disequilibration, right, of inequality, of internal redistribution within the institution. And of course, that then valorizes, we could say, a logic of arbitrage. And this is, of course, a moment in which arbitrage is reigning supreme. Arbitrage precisely has to do with the exploitation between what's expected and what is an outcome, and that valorizes the far from the mean outlier, as the great reward. That is to say, that risk-taking activity. But of course, one thing we know from the financial crisis is that that set of protocols to manage risk is what produces risk, is what produces the volatility. And here we are, of course, in the midst of that very volatility. So we have to also recognize the ways in which these solutions, these managerial solutions, have produced an absence of manageability in the name of a kind of rampant imperative or drive to give account that makes it impossible to know what knowledge is, what it's doing. But it also represents, we could say, an abdication of that larger vision, that larger set of claims. And I think this is very important when we start considering this kind of abdication by capital of this very utopian promise that things like development and progress and careers were supposed to deliver. Be patient, stay with us in real time, and we'll deliver a future that is out of time, that is in a different time, that is projected onto a different screen. Now all of this logic of accountability is to bring that future rushing into the present. You need to prove now that your strategic investment is going to pay off in the next time the measurements come out. And one of the things that these financial instruments do is they allow for ongoing real-time assessment before the product comes due. You could say that that's much of what the logic of a derivative is. It's taking these little bits and attributes of value, but doing that so that you can come up with a pricing of something that has not yet come to pass, and therefore leveraging a future into the present in which that future then becomes actionable as a decision that you can take, and therefore a kind of triage, right, against the great mass of population, against, again, this kind of essential singularity, this beneficiary. And it's the internal working of that that is an unworking, an unmaking of the meritocratic logic, of the self-governance, of the logics and principles of peerage upon which the professionals were based on and to which they would make their set of institutional claims. So what does self-dissemination have to do with this set of problems? It then really is a question, and I think when we talk about launching an initiative of electronic platform, a journal, we're really talking about trying to find a different way to affiliate and associate the work that we do together. I think it's really interesting to think about the nexus between the jobs crisis, the implosion of jobs, and the knowledge of and the knowledge expansion, explosion. I'm sure that if you are, you know, looking out, you would notice that barely a day goes by when a new journal isn't launched or announced. Right? And you could ask, then why could you be so stupid as to imagine starting yet one more? Right? But I think one of the phenomena that we're describing, of course, has to do with treating these journals already as not as contexts, even though they go farther and farther upstream of conversations, of specialized conversations that are taking place, and therefore lose that kind of leveraging, right, of how one intervenes into the world and where one can have the kind of command that would have real bearing on an institution, and therefore creating all these problems of translatability. But of course, the journals are not sold as singularities, they're sold as bundles. And they're sold as bundles to libraries. So that would be, of course, our version of this productivity gap. This we, which now is no longer just folks in research universities, which of course is but 150 of the 6,000 institutions of higher education, right, which at that moment of the gold, so-called golden age in the 60s, which I'm calling this interregnum, was in fact mistaken for the great mass, even as that great mass did not benefit, right, from this formulation of knowledge production as something that could be proprietary. Because indeed, the idea of the proprietary is that it is the conferring of education upon a student, and the management of that process that is where money is to be gleaned. So that question of a productivity gap, we're putting out more labor, right, not gaining from that, sets up the question of what it means then to engage in this kind of self-production, self-valorization process. And to do that, we have to think not just as the outcomes of our own research, our own work, our own efforts, but what does it mean to organize ourselves in some sort of meaningful engagement of the production of work? So the presentation on the Cultural CSA Journal today is based on this idea of open process as a kind of intensification of peer review, right? Of something that is constituting peerage, rather than taking it for granted as simply a kind of evaluative modality, something that stands outside and regulates and generates the kind of artificial scarcities for which we generate none of that surplus, none of that remaining. So in relation to that one problem of self-dissemination, we'd also have to think about that other moment of that conjuncture between the job crisis and the knowledge crisis. And that is opening up the question of what it means to have a job. How did we become so complicit in this idea that a job meant the replication of the mentorship relationship between a professor and a graduate student? And the placement, if that is the ideal, right, that someone would be placed into one of that 150, right, against the 6,000, and just inside of higher education and nowhere else. If in fact what we're talking about when we're talking about this loss of autonomy is already the evisceration of that boundary between what's inside and outside of higher education. And there's probably nothing more poignant about this kind of expansion of higher education than to look at where the greatest mass of the student body is, which is in continuing education and adult education, which constitutes 100 million students a year, as against 18 million who are matriculated students in programs of higher education. What's that about? It's about the elimination of upward mobility and the use of continuous lifelong learning, which is a managerial trope itself, right? That you're never going to stop learning because you have to be remanaging and re-engineering yourself. But it has to do then with using education as a modality of lateral mobility when upward mobility has collapsed because of this implosion of the professional managerial class. And the difficulty then of thinking about what job means if job is still organized along the professional craft model of the replication of the professions, which I'm suggesting has not been eliminated, but it's no longer something that can be promised as an expansive domain. And this is not, of course, something that we're making up in our heads. If part of that accountability issue is that the only thing that counts as the validation or legitimation of a department is whether it can, quote unquote, place students, right? And what counts as a place is only this very highly restricted economy, then we'd have to say there's a larger issue going on of a disjuncture between what's happening with higher education and its relationship to the mass of labor and its reproduction more broadly, and this more narrow craft conception of replication, which is decreasingly available. So how might we think about this dilemma? I would suggest that we might want to consider what it means for cultural studies to be not just professionalizing, but also post-professional. That is to say, being an occasion to intervene in those conditions of return to higher education, and no longer assuming that higher education through the credentialing process stands, right, as the epicenter of some kind of not lifelong learning, but lifelong security, right? Which is, of course, the dream of the tenure track itself, right? That you're gonna get the stamp and you're gonna be, you know, permanently installed, when in fact the world is going precisely in the other direction. And I don't want to say this to undermine any kind of aspirations for particularly those kinds of jobs, but to think about what kinds of movements, how do we think about making room in our own processes of professional socialization for this kind of counterlateral move. Right? If labor is moving laterally through higher education, what's our response? And I'm suggesting that one way then of following the knowledge production, the material forms of knowledge, the thought of the kinds integrations of knowledge production and labor, the articulations and disarticulations of labor and work, become part of that process. And I think we have to include in this process of the decomposition of the professional managerial class in the same 30-year period, the advent of self-production more generally as a phenomenon, right, of a labor reservoir, of a residual, of what's generally called the do-it-yourself movement, right? And do-it-yourself is not just a function of self-help, and self-production and new cottage industries, right? It's a suggestion now of a kind of round-the-clock, around-time production where labor is expanding way beyond what the unit of exchange, the job, can recognize. And this, of course, is valorized in many kinds of anarchist and interventionist projects, but it's also a much broader social phenomenon. And it's happening, of course, at the same time that we have other kinds of excesses of population, right? No longer are we looking to the world and saying, let's see, where can we get fresh pools of labor, right? The International Labor Organization estimates that the global workforce is 3 billion people. Well, that leaves about 4 billion outside of the thing called the workforce, right? And it's not clear that the unit called job, right, is an expansive entity in that older sense, right, that it's going to absorb all of these excess populations. So to do that kind of production, to do that kind of other kind of valorization of work means thinking through these lateral moves across sectors of the knowledge industry in which we're caught up in that very process of industrialization, which again is a move against the impulse to say, let us be autonomous, not in the philosophical, political sense, but in the sociological sense of, you know, let us assume that we have sovereignty over our own domain, rather than asking, what are the ways in which we might leverage that work that we have? And of course, when we start thinking about that activity of self-production, we're also starting to ask, what's the relationship between the professional association, which was epistemologically grounded, right, in which the confidence was, if you could claim a uniqueness of a knowledge domain, you would earn that autonomy, and a labor union, right, which is asking, what's the movement of a circulation of a certain kind of labor, how is that to be organized? And a lot of the anxieties, certainly in the private university sector, over graduate student unionization is speaking precisely to this anxiety. What happens if academic knowledge production understands itself also to be labor, rather than what is that preferred relationship, which is one of debt, right, where graduate studentships are forms of financial aid, not forms of production of surplus value for the university. And of course, what has happened educationally, as I think people here can tell you, is that graduate education has become a double session in that epistemological, and I'm calling it ontological moment, ontological because it has to do with these issues of performance as productivity, and therefore output, and therefore types of labor that are a form of being, right, and not just knowing. So graduate education has become this double session in both the specialization of knowledge and the understanding of what it means to organize, what it means to unionize, what it means to be labor in this broader sectoral sense or intersectoral sense, in this industrial sense. And that's not something that we need to conjure up as an idea, but we might want to ask, if the logic of the industrial union is being put upon us, what is our associational response? Obviously, we cannot become a national labor union, ha ha ha, that would just suddenly take care of this problem. And I don't know which way we want to go, whether to eliminate unemployment or eliminate employment, right? We would have to have that discussion here. I know we'd be divided on which way to go, but that simply states the problem, right? So thinking about those kinds of strategies do bear on the kind of work that we do together year round, and who is sitting around the table, and who we can reach out to, and who speaks, and if indeed the great bulk of higher education is both the professionals who are coming in through continuing education, and as Percy was giving us the mapping last night, most of the university is professional schools. You know, in 1970, over 40% of baccalaureate degrees were in the liberal arts. Now it's down below a third. Right? Business degrees have doubled, but so too have degrees in art. Right? So this kind of notion that there is a professional term, and is a notion that, of course, has also hit the humanities. The humanities are the privileged labor model for this very kind of exploitation we're talking about, right? The cross-subsidies that Christopher Newfield has described. And unless we stop the exceptionalism of saying we're just an object for ourselves and say, whoa, we have innovated these forms of of what are most important to this particular notion of capital, which is liquidity. The possibility of creating new revenue streams. And I would even suggest that this is a way of rethinking student activity as a form of something that can be leveraged to the future. Of course, Bob Meister down the road in Santa Cruz has talked about the use of students to reduce the bond rates that universities are using for their capital campaigns. But what does that mean politically? And the reason for that is that students, if you can continue to guarantee increased tuition, then students themselves become a guaranteed source of increased revenue that other revenue sources can't be. What does it mean to mobilize that liquidity of students instead of just bemoaning it? The other key source of liquidity, and it makes you vomit, right, to even think this. Makes me queasy, at least. The other, of course, is the notion that the time you spend in college is a lost leader, not for lifelong learning, but for lifelong giving. Right? This is the Harvard model. This is why there are 12 campuses that have an endowment that's sufficient to provide financial aid to students across the board. That is until the whiz kids who ran their investment portfolios hiccuped and screwed up with the rest of us. But that's only 12 campuses, really, that have the $1 million to per student ratio in their endowment to really do what needs to be done. It's not a generalizable model, but the model is that the student becomes a source of lifelong revenue. Can students begin to leverage that as a form of liquidity? Because this is the way we're being treated. This was the point of the subprime, is that labor, in moving from renting to owning, became a lifelong source of liquidity for particular forms of capital. And that encountered the knowledge failure, right, the failure of the economic quantitative models to contain the outlier, the black swan, as it's called, in relation to the narrow forecasting that all of those financial models are based on, which is a two-year interval, right? So if something is more rare than 2 years, basically you're up the creek. And the idea is to try and fulfill that effect. And it's funny that social scientists of finance have discovered performativity 20 years after the fact, that what they say actually has material impact, right? So it's sweet to see that kind of deferral nonetheless speaks to the knowledge crisis that is at the heart of this financial crisis that makes it make so much sense that student protests and mobilizations are the place where we would be seeing the political response to this kind of financial crisis. Which brings me to my third dimension of our work, which I will call self-representation, which has to do with how we project ourselves into the world. It's sometimes assumed that all we have to do is affiliate with social movements, with the world outside, with the political, and suddenly cultural studies will have meaning, the meaning it requires, right? But that sort of begs the question of the purported separation between an inside and an outside. And what I'm suggesting, if that separation has again imploded, what does it mean to be able to claim that relationship between cultural policy and the culture of policy? Right, the way in which accountability, the way in which performance norms, the way in which these kinds of managerial aspirations become normalized, become part of a kind of desire to accept risk, even if one suffers that kind of acceptance. And we certainly could see in the cultural studies genealogy, the Policing the Crisis book, right, is a clear trajectory, right, of the moment of the state in relation to the cultural, both its projection and its limitation. And we'd have to say that crime has moved to subprime. Both represent technologies of racialization, right, of redlining, of classifications of population, of pricings according to risk profiles, of what populations can bear and what can be harvested from them, in which case, finally, it's good to be poor and a person of color from that point of view. That one is actually a better revenue stream. So thinking about those sources of liquidity also force us to think about the larger questions of classification to which the cultural bears upon. You know, Adorno is the one that said, whoever speaks of culture speaks of administration. And he meant that culture refers to those entire genealogies of classification upon which populations are sorted and organized, to which the notion of a constituted or constructed whole is being produced. So when we think about that administrative work that's already in our midst, that touches upon the activity of the state, that is indeed part of the genealogy of cultural studies, but one that's often the most freighted, and partly because it has its organizational resonance, not with the professional association or the trade union, but with the political party. And whether one thinks about the political party as a discrete or determinant organizational form, it is definitely a register in which our administrative work touches upon, right? And the increase of that administrative work is, of course, our own state work that is in our midst. The conventional term for that, of course, is not administrative labor, because the administration are those other folks. It's called service. And what is service? But service is also the raced and gendered unpaid labor, right? It refers to slavery and domestic work that is taken on, of course, as anybody knows, the service is valueless within the university. So the best thing to do is to avoid it. Now, that's a peculiar position for someone in cultural studies to take on, given that so much of this interdisciplinary work has to do with starting something that wasn't there before, and therefore mastering and acquiring the knowledge of administration that one needs to circulate and produce and sustain this particular kind of knowledge. So what does it mean to embrace that kind of administrative labor? Again, you know, you'd think I was channeling, you know, Sartre's nausea here.
Again.
People are really going to want to drink after this. But to think about that now as something which is the way in which we already imminently manage the institution, you know, run the world, aspire to the state, and rather than thinking of that as a kind of self-negation that intellectuals don't do because they're free-floating and autonomous, that brings up these various organizational registers, and I'm calling them registers because I want to suggest that we're already circulating within these logics of organization, and the issue is not, God damn it, stop being so lazy and go out and organize yourself a revolutionary world party, but rather to think about the work that you are already doing in terms of these organizational trajectories. And I would say, therefore, that in terms of the work of the Cultural Studies Association, we might want to think then about much more explicitly and deliberately what are those moments of state intervention, of policy consequence, of trackings of the political with a ginormous P, right, that we can have something to say to and about, right, that begin then to act as if we're party intellectuals, even if there isn't a party that we're intellectuals on behalf of, because we are asked to act that way anyways. Right, through all of the state work, through all the administrative labor that we're already performing. So, just in sum, I think these three modalities of self-dissemination, self-production, self-representation, right, which are our appropriation or counter-appropriation of what has been do-it-yourself labor and the displacement of labor from jobs and from particular kinds of work that are nonetheless the free labor in our midst, which is something that capital demands of us, but we can also demand back because it produces a surplus that we can begin to make claim to and begin to identify with and begin to say we are making, and here are the concrete ways in which we're making. All of this, it seems to me, suggests two, I think, of the prevailing temperaments, political temperaments of our moment, right? Which goes back, I think, to the initial dilemma that I spoke of being both in something and against it, or cutting both ways, right? Cutting into the institution and away from it. One is that interventionist temperament, in which by being interventionist, you assume the world as it is, and you even think about the kind of blank irony of the yes men, right, who are making the world as they want it to be, but by enacting the corporate regulatory state-like model, in order to imagine what it might be for those institutions to operate as their own idealizations would suggest. And so those questions of voice, of tone, of temperament, of tonality, of touch, of tactility, that all of these interventionist modalities suggest, which is a way of thinking about how we value that work, that tactility of our own work, which is something that touches us and that we touch upon, that's very difficult to value, and it's one of the reasons, again, I think that the service moment of administrative labor is so devalued, because it touches us, but we don't know how to touch it back. And the other temperament or modality, which I would name as the utopian, which, as I said, capital has abdicated. It's given up on progress, on development, on those trajectories of the future. So what does it mean to reclaim it? What one George Bush or the other, I forget which one, they're kind of confusing to me, called the vision thing, but he certainly meant that in a kind of pastiche manner, since he was, if anything, lacking in vision. That's why it was a thing, right? Instead of something that would proliferate in the world. So that utopian temperament, that utopian possibility, that audacity to say something, frankly, as feeble as this, as us, could be celebrated, could be embraced, could generate the project that is the partiality that we want to see in the world. That invitation to project, even if fleetingly in our moment, that universe of possibility claims what the state in its own abdication of the universal, and I think we certainly see this in terms of the difficulty of this state that's the purveyor of the private, being able to speak of universal healthcare. It sounds wrong. Right? Because that's no longer an epistemological slot that the state can occupy, but we can. And we can do it simultaneously with this interventionist disposition. That is to say, we can cut through the institution and also imagine through the work, through the knowledge, through the interventions, through the very kinds of affiliation that we produce, something that gives the lie to the notion that there is nothing other than this particular future in the present. Thank you very much. Thank you.